Hello and welcome to today's episode of Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt, and today we're going to be talking about the ancient Egyptian calendar. Now, the ancient Egyptian calendar is really interesting because it doesn't account for a leap year. At least their proper calendar didn't. And that's one of the things we're going to be talking about today is how we actually had two calendars running side by side within the ancient Egyptian system. But before talking about the specifics of the calendar, it's first necessary to go into the Egyptian concept of time and the way that they looked at time. The Egyptians actually had two twin concepts of the idea of time that were put together. One of them is called jet. And jet means eternal sameness is kind of how we would translate it or conceptualize it. And this is really something that we can see as being somewhat associated with the god Osiris. The Osiris is a god who was born, he was ruling over the earth, he was murdered, his body was brought back together, he was revivified, he was reborn, but he wasn't allowed to come back to earth. He had to stay in the afterlife where he stays and he rules forever. And that's this kind of concept of eternal sameness. And that's more of probably of something similar to our linear time. So that's a concept that existed, that you have a fixed point and you're moving forward after that. But more important to them probably was what we call ne'eh, or cyclical time. And this can be best personified by the sun and the sun god Re, which is thought to be born each morning. He then travels across the sky, kind of aging as he travels. He then is swallowed by the sun goddess Nut and dies every evening at dusk. And he then travels through the afterlife or through the netherworld, where he has to battle certain demons. He has to meet with Osiris, and he's then himself revivified and reborn the next day. So that idea of a cycle that's constant really seems to be what's the most foundational ancient Egyptian concept of time. And it's, as with the solar cycle, inspired by nature. And we see that when it comes to the way that they conceived of their calendar. It was really inspired by the agricultural cycle in ancient Egypt. What do I mean by the agricultural cycle? Well, in ancient Egypt, like most early civilizations, heavily reliant upon agriculture. Agriculture, and especially productive agriculture, is what allows you to have surplus. And once you have surplus, that then allows for really civilization. You know, if we're talking about hunters and gatherers, you're only going out each day to hunt an animal, or you're going out to gather food. Well, the food that you gather, the animal that you hunt, is going to spoil pretty quickly. You're in a cycle of constantly looking for that next meal. You don't really have time for specialization because you're constantly in a cycle of, we need to get food, we need to get shelter, we need to follow these herds, we need to go to where the plants are growing this time of year and where they're producing fruit and those type of things. But once you have agriculture, and once you have a system where I, as a single farmer, can produce enough food for 10 people, for 20 people, that then allows those other people to not have to farm. And they then can specialize in other, what we would call craft production, right? So they can become potters. They can become lithic specialists who are making stone tools. We can have architects. We can have builders. So agriculture is really key for any society. And in Egypt, the agricultural cycle is all based around the Nile. So the Nile itself actually comes from farther within Africa. It flows from the south to the north. So it flows from the middle of Africa, from the Ethiopian highlands, down through Sudan, through Egypt, and then eventually leads to the Mediterranean. Well, each year in the summer, there's a monsoon season in the Ethiopian highlands. That monsoon season has a lot of water that's produced that helps to swell the banks of the Nile tributaries that eventually lead into the large Nile itself. And that then creates a flood. And that flood brings with it not just water, but it brings with it really dark, rich soil from that Ethiopian highland. And that provides a kind of natural fertilizer, which allows things to grow. So that season is actually the first season that we have. And that's actually when the Egyptian calendar would open up. It starts with that time of flooding, that time of potential life. We then move from the season of inundation or the season of flooding to a season of growing. So the waters recede, the crops are planted, they begin to grow, and then eventually we have a season where we harvest. This cycle of life in Egypt existed, well, pretty much uninterrupted until about 100 years ago. And that's where we saw attempts initially by the British to dam the Nile River. And then we have the building of the High Dam at Aswan, which occurred in the middle part of the last century. And those were all attempts to control that flooding for a couple reasons. One, when you're dealing with a natural flood, it can be too big or it can be too small. It can go far beyond what you would plan, in which case it's destroying houses, destroying homes, or it cannot be big enough and you're actually then not going to have good crop yields. In ancient Egypt, they actually helped to measure the tax rate by the level of the Nile flood. If you go to Egyptian temples, we see these things that we call nilometers, where they would actually mark where the flood was at. And based on that, they could then say, okay, this was a good flood. We can anticipate this type of harvest, which then leads to this amount of taxation. But in an effort to control that and also to get numerous crop yields in a year instead of just one, we had these attempts to dam the Nile River. And really, those attempts then resulted in a complete alteration of the daily life cycle in ancient Egypt that, again, existed from ancient times through until about the 20th century. As I said before, we have the High Dam at Aswan now, but there were other attempts before that to build a dam to control it. Now, this gets back to that idea of a cycle, right? We have a cycle of a flood, a growing, and a harvesting, much like we had that solar cycle. So this serves as the basis for the Egyptian kind of cyclical nature of life and thus their calendar. There's a couple problems that we see with this system, though. When it comes to calendars, there can be a couple different types. When we look at the solar calendar, we know that there's about 365.25 or 365 and a fourth days in a year. So we have a leap year. Every 4 years, we add an extra day to the calendar, and that's a way in which our calendar can maintain some regularity. Conversely, if we looked at a lunar calendar, the lunar cycle is only about 29 and a half days. So that's a calendar where that would also create a calendar that was off, because we're going to have, you know, not something that actually follows the way the Earth moves around the sun. And thus, with those calendars, if you don't account for that leap year day, if you don't account for that proper measurement of time, as you go forward, your calendar is eventually going to be off. So this was something that they saw. We also see stellar calendars where they're marking time by the rising and setting of certain stars. And again, that's going to be pretty regular as well, about 365 and a fourth day, depending on the star, if you mark when it rises, how it moves, where it moves to, and then when it rises again. Because as I said, those stars, much like our sun, are fixed points. So they're points that while the Earth is moving, they're remaining relatively consistent. Now, as I had said before, the Egyptian calendar is divided into three seasons: the season of the flood, the season of growing, and the season of the harvest. Each of these seasons is then divided into 4 months. Each month has 3 weeks, and each week is comprised of 10 days. They didn't have the same calendar structure we do in terms of a 7-day week, in terms of varying days, whether it's 30 days, whether it's 29, whether it's 31. For them, each month was 30 days, 3 weeks. 3 10-day weeks, and that's what gave us a total of 360 days. But they did realize that the calendar should be closer to 365 days, so they have what we call epigominal days. These kind of fall outside of this normal, regular structure. So they would add 5 of these to the end of every year. So what this means is that the Egyptian calendar, for most of the time, is actually going to be completely divorced from the seasons. It's a calendar that would actually move throughout the year. Because it only accounts for 365 days, we're losing a quarter of a day every year. Now, while that might seem to not be very consequential, you have to imagine we're dealing with a society here that's existing for thousands of years, that's maintaining this calendar for thousands of years. And so we'd reach a point where the calendar would be completely reversed, where essentially we would have a time of year that just doesn't coincide with what's going on with the natural phenomena. And there'd be about 1460 years before we'd actually have these kind of alignments where it would take the calendar to go from when it was perfectly aligned with the natural phenomenon back to when it was aligned with it again. And it's not actually until the Ptolemaic period, so until the period after Alexander the Great, when we actually have foreign rulers within Egypt ruling as pharaohs. So this is a little bit before the time of Cleopatra, but one of her ancestors, Ptolemy III, actually goes and adds a leap day to the calendar to help to stabilize it in a specific decree called the Decree of Canopus. But to go back, so we're talking about the kind of civil calendar here. And what I mean by civil calendar is this is the official calendar where they would record the king's year dates, where they would record things that happened. It was all using this. They would say year one of the rule of this king, month, you know, three of the season of growing, day, whatever. So that's how they would actually, you know, mark their time. But they also drew their inspiration from nature. So in ancient Egypt, the most important star would have been Sirius, or we sometimes know it as the dog star. The ancient Egyptians called it Soptet, which was transmitted into Greek as Sothis. This was associated with Isis, but it was also associated with the annual flooding. If you're tracking in ancient Egypt, when that star would first appear on the horizon, would then travel, disappear, and then would reappear, we actually have pretty much a near perfect 365.25 days. So this was something that actually would have been the perfect kind of calendrical marker. Not only that, but when it appears in mid-August, which is when we have the beginning of the annual flooding of the Nile. So this is actually a star which heralds the new year, which heralds the inundation. In addition to this, we have groups of what we call deacons. And these deacons are groups of stars that they would use for telling time. Now, we call them deacons because they'd be associated with the weeks. So they would appear, you know, every 10 days or so. And what I mean by that is, you know, we have a total of 36 deacons, and one would appear, say, at the 12th hour of the night. That's, you know, when you would see it. And then the 10th day, 10 days later, the next week, it would appear at the 11th hour. And they would use these deacons to mark time. And this would be accurate time, right? This would be the true time. This wouldn't be off like that civil calendar that we would see that actually marked the dates. This would actually tell you a good reasonable idea of where we actually were within the year. Now, it's a little bit tricky for us, though, because unfortunately, there's a lot of debate as to what exactly were the constellations that served as these deacons. And we don't really have agreement with that. When we do have some different sources that kind of show us images of these. We have the ceiling of Senenmut, for instance. Senenmut was one of the chief advisors to an important female pharaoh in the 18th dynasty called Hatshepsut. We have temple decorations. One of the kings of the New Kingdom, Seti I, another great king, we had it preserved in his tomb and in other tomb paintings. We have a famous water clock that existed at the Temple of Karnak. And these would kind of break down and show that Soptet, Sirius, right, where it would rise, where it would be in relation to the deacons kind of on one register, and then we would see the planets on another. But they weren't attempts at true representations. They weren't actually making a map. They're just putting these all together. So we don't exactly know where these would have existed. Now, these are the kind of two calendars that we have. One kind of unofficial, which they would track. But these would tell us where we're actually at in the year, when the Nile was going to start flooding, etc. And then we have that kind of civil calendar that was 365 days that would move. The interesting thing, and this really is a testament to how strong the centralized control was in ancient Egypt, is that the calendar that they used for the religious festivals was actually based on that kind of civil calendar. It was based on that calendar of the state of this is when we're marking time in years. So even though the Egyptians could see when Soptet would rise, when Sirius would rise, and this is when the Nile is going to flood, that was something that was observable, but that was not what they would actually then use to celebrate, say, the start of the new year in the temple. That would follow that early civil calendar. So to just kind of go through, you know, the months as they would exist, well, when we're dealing with ancient Egypt and how ancient Egypt was thought to come into being. Ancient Egypt was thought to be created through the act of Re, in one creation myth, creating himself out of waters, out of these chaotic waters where nothing exists. And this is something that directly comes from that flooding of the Nile, right? The Nile, which flooded every year, was what brought new life. So they would see this water come, cover everything, but then as the water receded, they would see the sprouting of new plants. They would see frogs and snakes and other amphibians. So all of a sudden, the land would be teeming with life as the flood waters receded. So they took that natural observable phenomenon and they projected it onto what they did with their calendar and with their mythological beliefs. So for them, that annual flooding was the start of the new year. This is going to occur, as I said, in mid-August or so. And the first day was New Year's Day. It was known as Wepet Renpet, which is the opening of the year. And this is also the birthday of the sun god Re. This is when, again, that first day of the year, that first emergence from those chaotic waters, just as ancient Egypt was emerging from the Nile flood, so too did the universe emerge. The sun god created himself. It's his birthday. That would have been their New Year's festival. Each of the months was associated with a god. So the first month we have associated with the god Thoth, that would have been its name. And as we go throughout the different months, they're not only associated with the different gods, but with the different festivals. So one of the festivals that we have within this first month is the Festival of Drunkenness. There's a whole podcast I have on this if you'd like to listen to that. But again, it was one of these festivals that was timed and it coincided with the inundation. It was a festival where it was thought that to celebrate when a goddess had destroyed mankind, or was rather about to destroy mankind, but she came upon a great field flooded with beer that had been stained with ochre to look like blood. She drinks it, gets incredibly drunk, passes out, and when she wakes up, she's in a better mood and she doesn't kill mankind. So that festival is actually occurring during this month. As we move through the other months, we see that there are other important festivals that are occurring. We see that as we move to the second month, which was associated with the god Menchet, we see there that again, we're here in September. We have some important festivals like the Opet Festival, which was a festival associated with Amun in Luxor. One of the things that we also see, though, and this is really hard when it comes to identifying specific festivals and what's going on throughout the year, is we do have some lists in different places, usually by kings, but they usually focus on some of the most important festivals in the most important locations. So we know that there's lots of local festivals that would have occurred that we don't have recorded. So when we're talking about what's going on throughout the year, there would have likely been many festivals in many different locations. And these actually would have been important, not just to build community, but it was a way in which individuals were supported. And what do I mean by supported? Well, in ancient Egypt, we have a principle that we call the reversion of offerings. What that means is for each of these festivals, gods had to be provided by people with enormous amounts of sustenance. We're talking about lists that talk about, you know, making thousands of loaves of bread and hundreds of jars of beer and wine. Well, the choicest of these would be given to the god. Now, the god exists in the form of a statue, and the ancient Egyptians knew that it wasn't as though these items were actually eaten or actually consumed in any way, but it was thought that the gods could, you know, smell them, they could take in their essence that way. And when they were done, these items would then be reverted back to the people. They would be given out as part of these festivals. So it would be a hugely celebratory atmosphere where individuals are, you know, almost in, I think, depending on the festival, a carnival-like atmosphere, given food and given drink, probably depending on what your tie was to a important priest, that would depend. Are you maybe just getting bread? Are you maybe actually getting some vegetables? Are you maybe even getting a little meat? Are you just getting beer? Are you getting wine? That probably all would have varied depending on your social status, but it was a way that it could really be inclusive. So these festivals that occurred throughout the year would have been really important. We have different festivals. For instance, we have a festival for Hathor. She actually would go and would visit the god Horus at his temple. One of the great festivals we have is known as the Beautiful Feast of the Valley, or sometimes you'll see it translated as the Beautiful Feast of the Wadi. And this is a festival that was very similar to the Dia de los Muertos or the Day of the Dead festival. These are festivals where individuals would appear to go to the tombs of their ancestors, of their family. Again, it was in a very celebratory atmosphere, but they would give them food, they would give them drinks, they would celebrate. And that really seems to be an important festival that we have, certainly within the Theban region, but probably elsewhere as well. Now, as I said, we've got many of these different festivals, some local, some national, occurring throughout this calendar year. Again, as ways of bringing people together, which probably, again, is one of the functions of religion, right? Certainly religion exists as a control mechanism in many cultures, but it's also meant to assert that control by providing ground rules for the ways in which community is formed and by forming the way in which people interact with each other. So the festival, these festivals that we see are really tied to that idea that we're going to bring people together. So certainly religion can exist as a control mechanism, because what religion is meant to do is tell you how you're supposed to act. That doesn't mean how you're supposed to act spiritually, but it means how you're supposed to act in reference to other people, how you're supposed to act in terms of your superiors, how you're supposed to act towards a god. So the fact that in ancient Egypt, there was no word for religion, that there was no separation of church and state. These festivals are all ways in which the community is being brought together. And the reversion of offerings is a great way that they can participate and get tangible benefits from these religious festivals. Now, I don't want to spend too much time going into all the different festivals because there are many, many. But what is important to talk about is the five epigomenal days. So I wanted to give some examples of some of the festivals, especially because I think it's so interesting that because the festivals were on this kind of, you know, solar calendar, that the festivals themselves were often not occurring when they should be. So you would be celebrating, you know, New Year's, which is supposed to be associated with the flood, sometime within the season of harvest. So that I think is kind of interesting. And I wanted to give some examples of some festivals just to show you what they were doing and kind of the way in which the calendar would be punctuated with different celebrations. But one thing I do want to talk about is the idea of these epigomenal days. And those are what I mentioned at the beginning, are the days that fall outside of these normal times. These are the extra 5 days that are added to the calendar, right? The calendar with its seasons, its months, its weeks only adds up to 360. So we have these 5 extra days that are added. And each of these are actually associated with the birth of a god. The first is associated with Osiris, the second with Horus, the third with Seth, the fourth with Isis, and the fifth with Nephthys. And these are times of year that you really had to be careful. And you had to be careful because, again, the Egyptians were all about the idea of a cycle. They were all about this concept of Neh I talked about in the beginning, that there were cycles that came and that occurred, and that's the natural order of things. And Egyptians were all about the idea of order. So when we have these 5 days that fall outside of the calendar, these are actually times when you have to be really careful. You have to watch yourself. And we will often see a reference to the plague of Sakhmet, which is one of the ways of talking about disease coming, you know, and occurring during this time. Because it's not a regular time. It's a time of, in a way, uncertainty. It's a time of chaos, of disorder. So these were times when you really had to be careful. And much like we had our calendar where we have the birth of a god on a certain day, even though it's moving and it's not occurring when it's accurately supposed to be, they still kept track to that. The Egyptians didn't really have a concept of astrology the way that we think about it. That comes into ancient Egypt much later. It's borrowed from other places in the ancient Near East, but they did really buy into this concept of mythological precedent. And what I mean by that is that if something occurred on one day, that day is then tied to that phenomena. And again, we're moved in a cycle. So for the Egyptians, they had what we would call books of good and bad days. And these were days kind of like a horoscope that would say, oh, today is the day that Seth was born. So it's a day that you really need to be careful because bad things happen on this day. Oh, this is the day Horus was born. This is a good day. Things, you know, could happen that could be good on this day. So they had this concept in their calendar of days that were good, days that were bad. They had the concept of this is a time when you're in danger. This is a time when it's more safe. And all of these things were associated with their calendar. So that's it for today. Hopefully you enjoyed hearing a little bit about the ancient Egyptian calendar. So that's it for today. Thank you for listening. Hopefully you enjoyed us having our brief conversation about the ancient Egyptian calendar and the ways in which ancient Egyptians conceived of time and the ways in which they kept time. I'm having this podcast come out, it seemed especially appropriate to come out around the time of New Year's, which is when it's going to originally post. Of course, for those of you who are listening to this months or even years later, thank you. I hope you still find it interesting. But for those of you who are listening to it when it first comes out, Happy New Year. Thank you for listening to this episode of Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. I truly appreciate you taking the time to listen to the podcast. If you like the podcast, please subscribe to it and rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever format you listen to it on if they allow that. If you have any questions or any feedback you'd like answered on the podcast, please, you can feel free to get in contact with me on ericsguidetoancientegypt.com or also through our Facebook page, Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt, or on Twitter at Eric's Egypt. I also have an audience survey on my Twitter and Facebook pages, so if you'd like to give me any suggestions or feedback there, please feel free, and thanks for listening.